The Guardian.
Hello, and welcome to what could be described in very webby terms as a Science Weekly and Tech Weekly podcast mashup. Alex Kratosky is presenter of Tech Weekly, and recently she released her new book, Untangling the Web. Although we know Alex as a journalist and broadcaster, she's also, it turns out, a highly regarded social psychologist in the real world. Her book is subtitled What the Web is Doing to You. So when I met with Alex, I first asked her to tell me, from a social scientist's point of view, what is the web doing to us?
The web is a technology. Now, it's not a neutral technology, because Melvin Kranzberg, who was a history of computers professor at Georgia Institute of Technology, has these great series of laws about technology. And the first is, technology is neither good nor bad, nor is it neutral. So with that, you know, kind of as a pressy, the technology is not doing anything to us. The technology is like the telephone. Right? The technology is like the telegraph. The technology is like the printing press. All of these things have been, there have been sort of social revolutions ascribed to each of these technologies. But ultimately, the word social is part of that revolution.
I mean, it's in a sense, we're talking about technologies allowing some other bit of human nature to come to light, which maybe hadn't done before.
Well, not even necessarily. And actually, another point of the book, and the way that I kind of express the idea that technology is not doing anything to us, is by looking at all of the things that we accuse the web of doing to us, whether that's changing our notions of privacy, of community, of family, of love, sex, death, hate, all of these things, and how we say it's changing us or changing those phenomena. But if you kind of strip back and look at everything from privacy to sex to hate to death to love and family and community, the social and the psychological reasons why we have performed the processes around privacy, what privacy means to us now is the same as it meant to us before the web. What community meant to us before the web is the same as it means to us now. It's just we're performing it in a different way. And interestingly, I think one of the areas that makes people uncomfortable about the web is that for the first time, we're actually able to see these social processes. Like, we can see how people interact with one another. We can see how social groups interact with one another. We can almost see our psychologies because we're using the web in such a way that we're just kind of pouring all of this there. Whereas before, we needed to make assumptions. We needed to understand social theory. You had to get a degree in sociology in order to sort of see how and why people trusted one another and what that meant. Now we can see communities because we can see, you know, dots and dashes that are connecting people and how groups form. So rather than it doing anything to us, one of my main mantras is that the web is a mirror, right? It's a mirror of us, of who we are in the 21st century.
Well, it's also a sort of data source about yourself and your social networks that already existed. The word social network is now ascribed to Facebook or MySpace or all those sorts of things. But social networks have always existed in villages, towns, whatever. I remember going onto Facebook for the first time in 2006 or 7, and as more people sort of, friended you and I friended other people, what you realize is I didn't know that my friend that person knew that other person there, and I didn't know that person knew three of my other friends there. That's quite interesting. I mean, it's kind of a curious thing, and then you can say to them, how do you know that person?
Yeah.
And in a way, apart from that bit of novelty, it was data about myself. The one thing that I suppose that has happened in the past few years, and the difference between what you're talking about in terms of the fact we were always doing this stuff, is that now it's recorded and recorded for all time. Whereas, you know, maybe in the 80s, say, if you're a teenager in the 80s,
is this an autobiographical
story? I was starting to be a teenager in the 80s, but it wasn't. No, I didn't have access to the house phone in the 80s, never mind anything else. In the 80s, if you were a teenager, you maybe had the phone, you had you went to parties, whatever else you did. But then everything that happened sort of stayed in that memory of those people and then disappeared a year later. Now, every single thing you do is there. And when teenagers now grow up and get jobs and stuff, they're going to have Facebook pictures on.
Absolutely.
Of them drunk in
gutters.
Absolutely.
Well,
is that fair?
If Facebook still exists. So I think that there's there's a massive assumption there that what we're putting online now will be there forever. First of all, it's a big storage problem, right? And secondly, will we have the devices that are able to read the technologies? The technologies of future can read the technologies of the now. Thirdly, is any of this going to be of interest? Will it just be collected and discarded at some point when we realize that we've filled up giant databases, you know, that have taken over the Gobi Desert or whatever? But I think you bring up a really important thing, and this is something that I've been exploring recently as I've been in Australia recently. I was in the Middle East recently. I've been in the US recently. And in all of these places, as I've spoken with people about exactly this question, I realize that often other people are framing it in terms of privacy, right? They're framing it in terms of, well, this is a massive breach of our privacy because everybody knows everything about everybody else, right? But I think that ultimately there's a different question here. And it's the one that you raised about, you know, in 10 years' time, teenagers are going to be going for jobs and people are going to be able to look back at their Facebook profiles of, you know, vomiting over somebody else at a pub. These things happen. I've seen them.
In Britain, it happens all the time. It's
pretty impressive. It doesn't just happen in Britain, that's for sure. Anyway, and I think this is actually a social issue more than anything else. Historically, as you say, we had our lives and we went through different phases of our lives. And this is something
we were allowed to forget.
This is kind of an important
part of human.
It's not that we were allowed to forget. We all have these social memories that remembers what you did as a teenager, right? If we were friends then, I would know what you did as a teenager. But everything since that time, I would have said, oh, well, Alok has changed, or Alok has become a different person, or since he started this job, or since he graduated from yada yada. You know, we had little life beats, as I've been calling them. We had almost coming of age rituals or rites that moved us from one period of time in our lives to the next. And we may not have forgotten that information. And sometimes they crop up at, you know, weddings and family reunions, and there's discomfort when, you know, granny comes up and says, oh, I haven't seen you since you did whatever you did back then when you were a kid. But now that the issue is that when you stick somebody's name into a Google search, whether you're looking for a date or whether you're just curious about who they are, everything comes up as if it's happening right now. And that's
And it's an extreme detail as well.
But it's coming up right now, as if this is who you are right now and you haven't changed, been rehabilitated, found and lost love, become a different, had many different identities, been, you know, all of that kind of thing as a psychosocial development. Because that's all come up right now, it's the other person who's making assumptions about who you are right now. And I think that's where we're starting to have social negotiations to recognize that that teenager did those things when he or she was a teenager, not necessarily when he or she is coming and applying for a job.
There's a chronology problem, isn't there?
Yeah, with absolutely. The web.
And I mean, there's a slight difference between, say, social memory and that you talked about, you know, you might remember something from a wedding or something 5 years ago, and something on Facebook, for example, is that on Facebook, you can see the actual pictures. But as you know, human memories are fallible. I mean, they're hugely changeable. And in a way, you remember only the nicest things anyway.
There's an interesting question of context. Exactly. Yeah. So we've got the ugly bits of nature that are just as sort of, they're weighted just as validly. I don't think that there should be a technological solution, because I don't think the technological solutions, I think those are sort of, those are sledgehammers attempting to deal with a kind of very nuanced social problem.
But knowing this, do you think that people are changing their behavior slightly? I don't want to get too much into how it's changing your brain or anything until
no,
later.
I refuse to get into that.
But in terms of how they're changing behaviors, for example, if you know this is going to be sort of stored, then you may avoid having pictures of yourself taken, or you don't send things in emails, you only have conversations. I'm not saying I do this, but I'm just saying people might, that just a slight subtle shift in the way we,
there may very well be a slight subtle shift. And I think that that's part of us becoming au fait with the technology and recognizing its role in our social lives. But, you know, there's plenty of teenagers still posting pictures of themselves vomiting on somebody else in the pub. And I think that the thing that concerns me most about this idea of bringing somebody up and having their entire lives presented to me as now is that that will change our behavior, in that we will no longer use the web to express ourselves and to make connections, because there will be too much of a potential reputational damage in the future. Or we will simply create a kind of a conformity layer that will mean that we will regress to a quite dull mean. We won't express ourselves. We won't try on different possible selves. We won't be potentially dangerous with ourselves, as you know, which is what happens as you grow and you make mistakes. We won't do those things. We may not do them in public, you know, online, in a place where they can be recorded in the future. Interestingly, when I was in New Zealand recently, there was somebody who was doing a research project and said, I'm curious about anonymity on the web. Now, anonymity on the web is increasingly eroding for many people's experiences because they're primarily using services that are tied to a so-called authentic identity, which is tied to your offline name, your offline self, your offline friends, your offline photographs.
Do you think anonymity, just as a side point, is actually impossible?
We're anonymous as we walk down the street, right? We're anonymous. We are potentially anonymous online if you use a variety of...
So people can find, as you say, your credit card details if necessary or... The NSA is always listening.
Yeah.
Hello, NSA, by the way.
Yeah. Hello, NSA. Hello, Prism. Hello, everybody. Potentially, yes, but why would somebody want to? I'm not going to go too deeply down into that granularity, but I think that anonymity, you can be anonymous walking down the street. You can be anonymous using certain technologies online. And so the question about anonymity, how people are using technologies online, is there's an interesting shift moving away from something like a Facebook, which is just, I'm just going to use as the market leader because it is the kind of shorthand for social networks and single identities, to something like Tumblr, for example, or Pinterest, where you don't necessarily have to register with your so-called real name. And if you don't register with your real name, and maybe it goes back to an email address or it could be a fabricated email address, at least there you have the opportunity and the possibility to play around with your identity as we did in the early days of the web, when we did have anonymity and, you know, we didn't necessarily have hello NSA listening in on our conversations when it wasn't necessarily as important because very little communication was happening via those technological pipes and waves and all of that kind of thing. We had the opportunity to use this space as a kind of, in the same way that, you know, if you go on holiday, you express yourself anonymously and you try on different senses of who you are. We had that opportunity early in the web. Increasingly, I think kids are starting to do the equivalent of putting up their hoodies and moving into a different place where they can wear those hoodies, as opposed to somewhere like Facebook where they have to take that off and they have to expose who they are.
Now, we've gone headlong into this over the past less than a decade. Is your book an attempt to sort of to take stock a bit, to take some pause and look at all these different sorts of relationships?
More than anything, it's to kind of address all of the polemic arguments on both sides. Unfortunately, I'm a scientist, which means that I like to toe the middle line. I don't like to say one thing is or is not, you know, in an absolutely definitive way. And it bugs the heck out of me when I see when I'm asked to speak at conferences or I'm asked to speak on panels or I go to panels and conferences where the titles are things like "The Internet is doing X." And it's either saving the world or destroying us. That really annoys me because very little of that is based on actual research. Most of the time it's based on a kind of a gut reaction to something that we're not really sure. We're really not sure what's happening. We welcome this thing into our lives, whether we ourselves have welcomed it because we're interested and curious or because of social pressure or because the government says if you want to renew your driving license, you have to go online.
There is a place for polemic to make us think, I suppose. So, I mean, take one polemic, for example, Nicholas Carr's book, The Shallows, which is doing one of the things that you hate, saying that the web is making us dumber. Now, Nicholas Carr's not a stupid chap. He's an interesting writer on technology. I don't agree with anything he's written on in this book at all about how Google, because access to information is easy, it means that our brains don't work very hard and it means that we're all getting a bit dumber. Now, I don't recognize that argument. Tell me why, from your point of view, it's a difficult... I mean, do you agree with that argument?
I don't agree with that argument, primarily because there's no...
evidence.
Empirical evidence for this. And also, you know, it's funny, I was talking...
But it's been an influential book.
Oh, yes, absolutely, because of the polemic, the provocative argument. And we refer back to the fact that my book has, you know, what the internet is doing to you at the end of it. Yes, the questions are provocative, but if you can back that up with empirical evidence, fine, then I'm happy to have that
conversation. So what's wrong with Nicholas Carr's argument?
It's not backed up with evidence. There is no evidence. There is no empirical evidence. Certainly, there's interesting questions around search and how we find information, how we find people, how we find love. But there's no evidence to suggest that it's making us dumber. In fact, you know, if I had a dollar for every time I didn't go to the bookshelf when my parents said, I'm not going to answer that question, go find a book or go look it up in the dictionary or whatever, then I'd be very, very wealthy right now. But, you know, hey, I go on to Google and I find out information all the time. I think also there's a whole bunch of different assumptions when you say smarter, right? Or when you talk about memory, people talk about memory when it comes to the web as well. People have kind of social representations is what we call it in my lingo. They've got definitions of what they think these things are. And your definition of what smarter is and what constitutes smarter may be different from my definition of what constitutes smarter and memory as well. There's a whole bunch of different kinds of memory out there. People talk about Google making us stupid because we don't need to put anything in our memories anymore. That's talking about recall. That's a different kind of memory than, say, episodic memory, or than, say, date-related memory, or, say, you know, sensation or emotional-related memory. We still have all of these different things. It's just our relationship with the technology is such that we're moving some of our memory resources into the virtual environment.
A lot of these polemics, though, do feed into a sense that we all get when accessing news online or watching videos or whatever else, that there is just so much stuff. And we forget so much so quickly. It's a worry that people might have. Whereas, you know, in the good old days of rose-tinted spectacles and things, where you'd spend every day reading books, probably. I don't know if anyone's
reading. That's right, by candlelight, damn it.
And learning
piano.
Languages and piano and stuff.
Absolutely.
But there is that sense that now you have so much access to the world, you realize suddenly what you're missing in the rest of the world. And perhaps that. That's what feeds into these sorts of arguments like Nicholas Carr's and others, that we're just not intelligent anymore. We're not seeing all this stuff. We're not experts in anything. We want these serotonin hits with one bit of news or one Facebook like or something so much that that's all we do. But I mean, from your sort of attempt to rebalance this, what is good about this sort of massive information? Why is that a good thing?
Because we've got access to a massive amount of information.
I mean, even if we can't process it
and
sort of contextify it, then what's the point?
But we have access to it. It is there. You know, it's interesting you talk about this notion of information overload. And there's a book that's coming out next year by The Economist's digital editor, or editor of digital, I don't know what he plays by, but Tom Standage. He's written some fantastic social histories looking at not just the web, but also things like, you know, Mechanical Turk and how technology has been used to bamboozle people, or even he's done a whole thing on gastronomy and food. But his forthcoming book is about social media, but social media from the 16th and 17th centuries, and how people even at that point believed that they were completely overwhelmed with information. When the printing press arrived, people thought, dear God, we couldn't possibly understand, comprehend, get through all of these books that are now, and pamphlets and all of this. It suddenly just flooded our experience of the world. And, you know, we had these dialogues at that time as well. The Telegraph, absolutely. People were freaked out by the amount of information that we had to parse. Personally, my attitude, my philosophy is that if there's more information and it's accessible, then brilliant. It is a library at my fingertips. It is the most extraordinary, wonderful archive of information, both true information and false information, absolutely. But it's the most wonderful archive that means that we can access this kind of thing at any time. And that, to me, far outweighs this notion of kind of the information overload that you're talking about.
So that's great, and it makes complete sense. But it also means that information, plus also all the personal information that we give from, you know, our own bank details to where we are every day, is also available for governments to have a look at. And, you know, this is very key right now with the revelations about the National Security Agency in America, the GCHQ in the UK, with that mantra of theirs, just collect it all. We don't know what to do with it yet, but we'll just collect it all. I mean, it's sort of a brazen, sort of horrible way of dealing with this. But when you saw that, you've got to think there's a dark side to this.
Oh, to be honest, when I saw that, I laughed because I honestly thought privacy was going to rear its head and people were going to get really upset about privacy and virtual surveillance, you know, 5 years ago, and they didn't. You know, occasionally you get blips about privacy. It happened maybe a year ago, 6 months ago with Google and Facebook. You occasionally get these little blips. Now, I did my academic research, my methodology that I used for my PhD work was social network analysis, right? So we didn't call it big data then, but we certainly called it a whole bunch of data. And I actually had to reduce the amount of data that
I
had.
Did you do it with biscuits and gravy?
Pretty much. We rolled them out and then we stuck little Twizzlers between the different biscuits, and that represented our social network. That probably would have been a bit more fun, actually, than what I did, slaving away in front of the computer terminal. But so one of the things that I got really interested in when I was doing all of this social network analysis, and I had 15 million potential connections, and I had to reduce those connections to 47,000 just simply because it was not parsable. I was not getting anything meaningful out of the data. And it gave me an enormous respect for how we deal with big data, how we deal with collecting everything right now. It doesn't matter, honestly, it doesn't matter if it's about human beings or if it's about what's happening in the Large Hadron Collider, because frankly, they're collecting all the data as well and holding on to it and saying, how much should we hold on to? They're discarding some of it in the same way that the NSA is discarding some of it that at the moment it doesn't feel very interesting. Even more so, moving further back, epidemiological studies, looking at cohort studies, you know, things like Child of Our Time and all of that. We've got people who are designing collection techniques, discarding certain elements of what they're going to collect and what they're not going to collect, because it's just not possible to create anything that's meaningful necessarily out of bringing everything to the table and laying it out there and mushing it around. So yes, when I heard about the NSA, and PRISM and GCHQ and all of that, I did kind of laugh because I thought, finally, people are going to start taking this seriously and they're going to stop just automatically believing in the machine. They're going to stop thinking that Google is giving you know, Google is an oracle. They're going to stop necessarily uploading their stuff to Facebook and telling their friends everything that they did, because they're going to recognize that this is a public platform. This is not you hanging out with your friends. This is not, you know, you searching in the privacy of your own world. This is a corporate enterprise in which we are in public. I've been very, 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 very interested in how people, researchers in the first instance, how they kind of communicate that with their research subjects in internet studies. And how, in fact, that's different, for example, in journalism. You know, I've seen many instances of journalists pulling tweets out of Twitter from somebody making a comment and then without asking, just plonking it into an article.
It seems to become the way of getting responses, which I think is quite lazy, but it has become a thing where something happens and then someone tweets and your response underneath, instead of ringing them up and asking them, you say, this person tweeted this response.
That, or even sometimes without even the question, you know, what do you think about this? You know, I've seen people take that kind of thing and putting it back into a public environment. There's lots and lots and lots of different issues about the ethics of big data that I think are absolutely fascinating. And I more than anything, I'm simply afraid of the assumptions that will be made about human behavior and about expectation and about what it is that we do and don't do that are false positives, that are simply correlations that exist just based out of the enormity of the data set that they have. Also, we have to recognize that, you know, it depends very much on the questions that they're asking as well. Are they asking questions that are relevant to information before the web, or are they only purely looking at information post-web? Because I've got a life that, as we talked about before, is not recorded by the web, just by the nature of the fact that the web kind of landed in my lap in 1996 was the first time that I used it. Everything that's happened subsequent to that, you know, we've got conversations that need to happen about it. But we need to be really, really thoughtful about how that data is crunched and what assumptions we actually make out of the data.
We perhaps do, but going back to the snooping, that's what I'm kind of curious about, is what your thoughts are on that. Is it just inevitable that the security agencies are going to take everything?
Yes.
So then what do we as citizens need to be up in arms about? I mean, we know that they're going to take this stuff. Do we need to stop putting stuff up? Do we need to make sure we lobby for laws to stop them from just randomly searching that data? What is it you think that comes out of that sort of revelation for you?
What's more interesting is the relationship between the corporations and governments. Again, it's, I think, in many ways because we forget that we're dealing with corporations when we're using Facebook or Google or, you know, Tumblr or any of the other services that we're using. Those are companies, right? They're not like, you know, philanthropists who are just like, here, man, have my stuff. You can just play with it, whatever. Cool, that'd be great if it was like that, but that's not the way of the world. the reason why all of this data is collected and the reason why it's observed and sifted through is simply for commercial reasons and for security reasons.
Well, I mean, I use Google for almost everything on the web, including the email here at The Guardian's all Google-based. And one of the things that someone once told me a while ago, which has changed my view of that company, not in a particularly negative way, but just it made me see it again, was Google just wants you to spend as long as possible on the web so they can sell advertising to you. I thought, fair enough. That's why they build all these things. You'll spend as long as possible on the web. They bought YouTube for that reason. They give you free email. They give you free docs and collaboration tools. I mean, they're not about necessarily giving you these wonderful things just for the good at heart. They want you to say, and that makes complete sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
But once you realize that, you think, okay, there is a commercial incentive here, and all of my stuff is owned by them, essentially.
Totally.
It's on their servers.
Totally.
But they provide a decent service for free, so you can't complain.
Brilliant, fantastic, yes, and that's the so-called cost of free. This is something that I was trying to convey to friends when they were just sort of loading all their photographs on Facebook, which doesn't have, you know, a Creative Commons license. The ownership of whatever it is that you put onto Facebook ultimately is in the hands of that company.
Is that really true? So all my photos on Facebook are owned by Facebook?
Yes, absolutely.
I'm taking them down tomorrow.
but trying to kind of explain to people why that's an issue has always been difficult until, thank you NSA and Prism, in some ways you've made my job easier. You know, information. So there's a lovely definition of privacy by Audrey Nissenbaum that's been expanded on by Dana Boyd. And it's the notion of contextual integrity. So the idea here is that what privacy is a trust relationship, it's a social contract between yourself and entity that you stick information in. You expect, hope, trust that whatever entity it is will not do anything bad with your data, that the data or the information or the photographs or the secrets or whatever it is that you've put into that entity, whether it's a computer or whether it's a friend, that information won't end up somewhere that you didn't expect. And what's happened now is the information that we put into these systems that we had no business trusting in the first place, because, you know, hey, it's brilliant that they're offering these services, but they're not our friends, you know. They've got commercial interests.
Do you think
interests.
Enough people That's care about this? I mean, this is what sort of comes out of this for me, which is that people sort of shrugged their shoulders when all the NSA leaks stuff came out. And I mean, for example, I came to this interview, half an hour ago. Before that, I was watching Stephen Colbert dancing with Hugh Laurie and Jeff Bridges
really
to Get
job.
Lucky.
You know that.
So I was just watching that, and isn't most of the web videos, spoof videos, and cats.
Lots of cats.
And
I found one.
What you're asking people to do, what you're asking people to do, is think really hard about this stuff. Which, they, of course, they should. But it's like eating vegetables or thinking about your mortgage. You know, you don't want to think about things that are essentially services that hard. But then, the result of that, of course, is that, you know, your stuff's everywhere, and you're not, you know, Facebook owns your photos and NSA's watching everything you do.
But it's even more than that, and this is an area that I'm pursuing at the minute, which is, what are the ideologies that are built into the technologies? So I said before that technology is neither good nor bad, nor is it neutral. If we think of technologies, if we think of the infrastructure of the web, this invisible technology, the internet, the tubes that run underground, those were built with a particular ideology, which is not to be broken, right? To get around, that everybody can access it. Well, then you apply that to what are effectively cultural artifacts. They're created, you know, things like Facebook or Google or Tumblr or Twitter or Blogger or whatever, all of these different things. They've got little sort of signatures of their authors, right? In the same way that you recognize a Spielberg movie, or, you know a Gordon Ramsay dish, or, you know, you see Stephen Colbert and you know what you're going to get, right? Whether it's dancing or whether it's pictures of cats. All of these technologies also happen to have ideologies, and they've got little spins on what they think human beings are, because they've had to reduce human beings into ones or zeros in order to produce the services that they provide that have been, you know, hugely successful. Moving from, you know, something that's soft and fuzzy. I was just listening to an interview with Douglas Rushkoff that we recorded several years ago, and he's an author in the US. And he says you move from quite a sort of a warm, fuzzy, very personalizable environment, say like MySpace or any other sort of online thing, to something that's very regimented and fixed, that's very sort of formatted like Facebook. And there are different things that you can do with that technology. And it's simply the way that they decided to operationalize what it was that they thought human beings were and how that then fit into what it was that their output is. And so that, I think, is that's a really interesting sort of movement that is part of this whole thing where we're starting to raise our periscopes and say, hold on a second. It is all about silly cat videos, and it is all about getting really easy access to information, and it is all about connecting with our friends. But how are we doing that? Why are we doing that? And who's saying how we're doing that?
Well, the web has also, you know, become increasingly politicized as a sort of vote-winning strategy. I mean, David Cameron, for example, the UK Prime Minister, is convinced that by putting a filter on all pornography in the UK, that somehow the UK's moral fiber will be improved. And of course, that's A, not possible. I'm not even going to ask if it is, because it just seems like a stupid idea for that reason. But it's going to get him a lot of votes, because people don't really understand how the web works, even though they use it all the time. And it goes back to that thing I said earlier about people have this sort of creeping feeling that there is some change around them. There's all this stuff out there. They don't know what their children or themselves are able to see. But it was ever thus, right? I mean,
absolutely.
You know,
we've never.
What was your response to the porn filter idea?
I honestly rolled my eyes, and not in a good way. I was just frustrated because, well, in one way, you've got basically the ISPs collecting opt-ins on pornography, violent content, suicidal content, you know, all of these things. Basically, you've got a list of people who are like, yes, I want to look
at
porn.
To see, yeah.
Yes, I want to look
at violent
content. I want
to see abuse
content.
Online, please.
I want to do that. So it's like, brilliant. Okay, thank you very much. We're just going to feed that beast. But also, it's, as you say, as was ever thus. In many of the conversations, particularly around sex, right, and this has been historical, whether it's gendered or whether it's not, there's been an assumption that human beings are morally corrupt, and that as soon as you are exposed to anything about sexual content, then that means you will instantly devolve into some kind of slathering, sort of knee-rubbing pervert. Alec, you seem to be...
Don't pause when you say that and look at me for some reason.
You seem to be holding up quite well. How's the therapy? But I think that there's an assumption there that about our conversations about sex in general. One of my first thoughts after the eye rolling and after thinking, you know, we're gonna have a really lovely list of people who want to look at porn, is, why aren't we having those conversations that are making us uncomfortable with the people?
Because of the Daily Mail?
With the people that we're, you know, why aren't we having those conversations? You and I don't need to have that conversation, but, you know, you and your kids need to have that conversation. This is the issue that we're creating a scapegoat in the web, because it's there and it can't really fight back. And by having people who don't really get the web come in and mediate and say, we'll solve the problem, then we're actually setting ourselves up for a fall. That kind of thing just won't fly, frankly, because it's not nuanced. A technological solution in all of these instances is not the way to do it.
Well, as you said, also, the web's designed for people to get around almost everything.
Exactly.
So you can easily get around those things.
We saw this in Egypt, you know. We've seen this in so many cases.
What do we do about abuse online? People being abused, mainly for being women, essentially, having an opinion and being threatened with all sorts of things. It's, again, in the news. I mean, a part of me thinks that, again, this was ever thus, unfortunately. But is there a role for these private companies, governments, people like you, to think about what happens when the really dark, nasty things about people have always been there come out and are easily accessible and, you know, are dangerous to some commenters on the web?
There's a really lovely way that community forms. I swear this is related. One of the key elements that brings groups together and helps them to form a group identity is a common enemy. And what trolls and what abusers and what all of this online is serving a purpose that's helping community to grow, thrive, and prosper in many ways. So in some ways, we can thank these people. Obviously, we don't want to give them a medal and we don't want to say, brilliant, here, you know, come hack into my community and come ruin my day or my life. But as a kind of macro understanding of what's happening in terms of a group process, that's an interesting thing. Back in 1993, there was an incident in a text-based virtual world that was called Lambda Moo. Lambda Mu was very popular. It was one of the most popular virtual environments at the time. It was a bit like Second Life, if you can remember Second Life. It was kind of like a chat room in which everybody could communicate, and it perpetuated and all of this kind of thing. There were academics who were really interested in it. Journalists got really interested in it. And of course, the people who were in that environment got really interested in it. And there's a journalist named Julian DeBell who wrote a wonderful piece. In fact, the reason why I'm here today talking about this is because of Julian's book, Julian's article in The Village Voice called A Rape in Cyberspace. And in 1993, there was a very tight community of people who were using Lambda Mu. All of the hallmarks of community existed. There were hierarchies that had emerged. There were love relationships, there were economies, there was value. All of the things that we experience offline were happening online. And it was also kind of a very idealistic, sort of socially open, anybody can contribute to the conversation, let's have meetings to have meetings to have meetings kind of thing. So one day, two of the most popular people in this community, who happened to be women, were kind of hanging out with their friends, bunch of, 50 or so people in the virtual common room, bearing in mind this is all text-based, and in walks some guy who calls himself Mr. Bungle. Mr. Bungle happened to be somebody who had skills with computers, who hacked in to these two women's accounts and then proceeded to get these two women in front of all of their virtual friends to perform quite lewd and explicit sexual acts upon his virtual body. And this was called a virtual rape. This happens a lot. It happens even in Facebook. It happens all over the place, right? It's a way of trolling. What was really interesting were two things. First of all, the two women who were affected were very affected because they had poured so much of themselves, their identities, into this community and into these avatars. And they felt violated, even though they were, thousands of miles away on the other side of a computer screen typing into a keyboard. They actually felt vulnerable. So the connection between the trolls that are attacking women in virtual worlds or women in Twitter or women in Facebook or whoever it is who's being attacked, There is an emotional connection there between the individual behind the keyboard and the entity that's virtual. But what Julian described, I think, is another interesting feature, which is he described it as the day a database turned into a society. Because what happened after that incident and after Mr. Bungle went away and everybody kind of was shocked was everybody, except for Mr. Bungle, who was sort of immediately banned, but banned in the sense that he couldn't log in for a period of time, came together and tried to decide what to do about him, what to do about this infractor who had created this sort of very tense and difficult situation. And eventually, so the up for grabs were things like, let's just block him for a little while, or let's kill him. And by killing him, that means never allowing him or the person who operates the account based on, his IP number of his computer ever to come back into this community again. But this very sort of hippie, happy-go-lucky, let's have meetings to have meetings community, because they had this infraction, suddenly everybody realized that they needed to create rules and regulations. They needed to create some kind of hierarchy, some kind of rules, boundaries of what it meant to be part of the community. You see this again and again. And often the community has this weird kind of relationship with the gods of the service, is what I like to call them. So the gods of Twitter, the people who run Twitter, the gods of Facebook or whatever. They don't want those gods to be involved in their everyday community things, because they're like, hey man, back off, we're doing our thing, you've given us the platform, thanks very much, until such time as something like this happens. And then suddenly they go, whoa, we can't handle this ourselves, gods, please help. And that's actually what seems to have happened eventually in the case of Twitter recently with the scenario of the bomb threats and the explicit sexual threats, is Twitter turned around and went, okay, fine. We're not going to be too heavy-handed about this because we're going to get even more complaints if we are too heavy-handed because you like your open and free community. But what we will do is we will give you the tools that will allow you to report somebody back to the authorities so that in such instance, we can act as the final say. So, we've seen this again and again. This is literally a community process that happens offline as well as has translated online.
It's a difficult no-win situation for Twitter, isn't it? Because if they are too heavy-handed, then people will just leave the service because you can people can abuse the abuse system. You know, if you're if you decide you disagree with someone, you report them, and then their opinions disappear whilst it's being investigated. Is there anything they can actually do? Is it just something we have to live with?
In some ways, yes. I recently spoke for Tech Weekly with a researcher named Claire Hardiker, who did her PhD looking at trolling behaviors and the different kinds of trolling behaviors. Her next piece of research is to try and understand the best methods of eradicating trolls, getting rid of trolls. And one of them, she says, is you know, you can either do that block or ban or ignore things that the troll basically doesn't get fed, doesn't get off on, you know, whatever reaction, and then just realizes it's kind of a no-win situation and goes away. That's kind of like the long game. But the other option, she says, that seems to be quite high risk, but very potent, is to turn around to the troll and just goad them and say, is that all you got? Come on, give me some more. Give me some more.
Yeah, the danger is the real world sort of a manifestation of those sorts of threats.
Of course. And I think that in some ways we have to respect and celebrate the fact that we have an anonymous or a relatively anonymous platform or this sort of online disinhibition effect, because it is very, very, very unlikely, very, 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 very hopefully unlikely that people will translate what happens online to offline, especially. And we've had these kinds of conversations around video nasties. We've had these conversations around video games in the past, movies, anything. That's the sort of the enactment in a kind of in a role-playing environment in which the perceived consequences are less, in some ways blows off steam. Now, I also have been a victim of hack attacks. I've been victim way back in the day when I was doing a computer games program called Bits. We would get absolutely eviscerated with the most violent, disgusting language that you can ever experience. And I'm absolutely devastated that we have to continue having these conversations, because that happened like 15 years ago. And yet we're still seeing this.
But new forms of media turn up every time, I suppose. And then that's why these conversations come up. The conversations are universal and perennial.
But it's still the same common thread.
Well, isn't these sort of kind of, you know, the problem with this is that the commonality amongst all these things is the human being.
Oh, damn you humans. Yes, exactly. Well, obviously, so, I'm going to bring it back to that because I'm a social psychologist. Yeah. And I'm always going to look at the human being as the center of the universe.
As the enabler for all this anyway. Whatever new media comes along, you will find a way of doing this.
Exactly.
Alex, let's finish on a positive note. This
Please.
Is getting a bit dark.
I know. I
think. Now, you said that technology isn't positive, isn't negative, it isn't even neutral. But I think you are a web idealist, aren't you? You like the web. You think it's a good thing.
I think it's a good thing.
You think it's a good thing. Okay.
I'm not a utopian. Okay. I'm not. I want to emphasize that I'm not a utopian.
Okay, but tell me what excites you most about the next 10 years of the web.
More than anything, I think a maturity for how we're going to be using it. I know that doesn't sound sexy and whizzy and Google Glassy or anything like that, but you know, just seeing how we evolve with it. This idea that we are going to become more critical, which means that we're going to be able to kind of reassert ourselves in some way and realize that we don't need to be techno-fundamentalists. We don't need to believe everything that's online. And we will start to see a critical capacity in the same way that we've seen a critical capacity with newspapers, with television, with cinema, with other forms of media. You know, the idea of just blindly believing something online, I hope will go the way of the dodo as we develop a maturity with the information that's online.
I mean, this is only 22 years old.
I know, it's so young.
Yeah.
God, what was I like at 22? I don't even remember.
It's on Facebook.
Yeah, no, it's not. It was pre-Facebook. Actually, I think some of it might be.
Alex, thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Alex.
Untangling the Web is published by Faber and Faber and available in all good on and offline bookshops. However, as a loyal Science Weekly and or Tech Weekly listener, you can, until October the 7th, get the book at half price on the Guardian's bookshop site. If you want the code for that, just click on the extra information on this MP3 or go to the blog, theguardian.com/scienceweekly. Click on the blog for information and you'll get your half price book. Exciting! It's time to untangle the podcasts and say that Tech Weekly will be back Wednesday week in its usual slot, and Science Weekly will be back next Monday with an update on this year's British Science Festival in Newcastle. I'm Alok Jha, and Tech and Science Weekly is produced by Jason Phipps. Goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.